Welcome to the Not Alone Podcast, a discussion on all things mysterious and unexplained. I'm Sam Fredrickson.
And I'm Jason Moitoso. Today we'd like to, first off, thank you for tuning in and listening to our podcast. This is our very first episode, and this is probably the most time I've ever spent in a podcast alone. Sam here has a little bit more experience than I do.
I'll tell you what. Okay, I came to Jason with this idea. I said, hey, buddy. And I was joking at the time. I said, hey, buddy, do you want to be a co-host on a podcast with me? And Jason, the ever willing, was, yeah, sure, man. So I said, okay, cool. And in the back of my mind, I thought, he knows what a podcast is, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
I've heard of them.
Not listened
not
to them.
Not heard them.
Different,
so,
yes.
It came out today as we were sitting here setting up that Jason has never listened to a podcast in his life, so...
Oh, no.
He's had about 4 minutes.
Where do I find them? That's the toughest thing
for anybody who doesn't know, you can subscribe through the podcast app on iTunes. So there we go. Thank you for that little plug. So what are we talking about tonight?
Tonight, listeners, we'll be discussing apparitions just kind of in general. Ghosts, geists, spooky things all around. One of which, once we get later into the podcast here, are going to be crisis apparitions. We're going to take a deeper look at some of those stories, which are essentially apparitions that appear to loved ones either just during or right after their death. But Sam, why don't you take us right into our first story here today?
Yeah, I promised in our first blog post, the first ever post on notalonepodcast.com, that we would be covering stories ranging all the way from biblical times up to the present day. And that's exactly what we've got for you. Our first story comes straight out of the Old Testament, the book of 1 Samuel, chapter 28 to be exact. Now, it deals with the prophet Samuel and the Hebrew king Saul. Saul journeys to the village of Endor, and no, Jason, that's not the one with the tiny little Ewoks.
Okay, good. I was getting a little confused there.
I understand. Go on. All right. You got a specific frame of reference you're dealing with, and I can dig it. At that village, he meets a medium, which is a psychic that can communicate with the souls of the dead. This particular psychic communicates with the soul of the prophet Samuel, who had died a little bit before. The Bible tells us that the ensuing conversation is not one of particular warmth. There's no good to see you, or how are your sons doing? Good? Well, not for long. They didn't talk like that. They didn't say anything along those lines. Instead, the king is rebuked by the prophet who had anointed him in the first place, the one who made him a king, telling him that if he doesn't get right with the Lord, a face-to-face intervention with the creator of the universe might be in order for him. Now, this is especially ironic because mediums and soothsayers were strictly prohibited in Saul's kingdom on the ground that they were often seen as consorting with demons and that anything they say could not be trusted but was to be disregarded as the whisperings of the damned through decree of King Saul himself. So it's a little strange that he would go in the first place to see a psychic, but as soon as he did, we can tell, or at least biblical scholars can tell, that because the conversation aligns with the perceived will of God within that book, biblical scholars seem to agree that this was the real deal. It's not a demon, it's not some sort of trickster god or spirit or anything like this. This is an honest-to-goodness ghost, and I think that that might be the only one, in my research at least, that I could find in the entire Bible, Old Testament or New Testament. This is the only one I could find.
Yeah, I find that actually to be pretty interesting that Saul would speak to a medium. Sam,
he was not a smart man. I mean, well, he was a king. He was all right. He did his thing, but
not the wisest.
You know, you read the Bible and you just see people making stupid mistakes and you know they're stupid mistakes and you want to go back and slap them. And that's kind of how I feel here, but...
Gotcha. Well, that's going to be an interesting story, and I think that's one that is always going to be up for debate just from the story, the history of it. So, and thank you. I know it's not with Ewoks.
Right.
And I was honestly kind of keep my fingers crossed that there would be a sly little Ewok shoved in there somewhere, but nope, that works. That's fine with me.
Now, you mentioned history, and on that note, I hear you have quite the story for us.
That's right, Sam. Now we're going back to one of my favorite eras, the American Civil War. To be more specific, the Battle of Gettysburg. The date was July 2nd, 1863. Scores of brave men were engaged in bloody struggle on the rocky hillside of Little Round Top, an area just outside the town of Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, part of the larger battle that ravaged the surrounding areas. Out of the smoke of cannon blasts, a single rider appeared, right in the line between the Confederate and Union armies. The rider looked to be as real as you or I, dressed in the traditional Prussian blue coat of the Union cavalry. The sight was beheld by both sides of the battlefield. Dozens of Confederates chose to abandon their previous targets in favor of shooting down the foolish Yankee crossing the field. Their bullets flew through the air and appeared to riddle the lone horseman. But his charge continued. There was no sign of impact, no stagger to indicate that he had been wounded whatsoever, not even grazed by a single Confederate shot. He simply rode onward, back into the smoke and carnage of the battlefield, to disappear from view. Later that day, as Union soldiers decided to make their final charge down the hill, the rider is said to have reappeared, leading the Union forces to victory. Gettysburg is still one of the most haunted sites in America, with untold numbers of apparitions, and it's been over 164 years.
Wow. Truly astounding. So, to you, or from what you're saying there, it sounds like this wasn't some kind of hokey, oh, there was a strange mist that appeared, or not to discredit that, but nothing subtle about it. It was a man on horseback riding, getting shot by dozens and dozens of other people and not even breaking stride.
Yeah, I think the cool thing about this horseman tale is the fact that both sides reported seeing it. And that, for me, is it's probably one of the coolest aspects of it. And it, for myself, it feels like this lone horseman was there to rally the troops further.
Interesting. So. And if I remember correctly, this isn't just some sort of a diary report. It's not something we found written, you know, on a scrap of paper in some 200-year-old home, but they actually reported their experiences to Colonel Joshua L. Chamberlain, and those stories actually made their way to the War Department and were investigated. So that is quite the...
Astonishing.
Yeah, quite astonishing.
That's really quite incredible. And, I mean, as far as I know, I, of course, knew Gettysburg was a haunted location to this day.
Right.
I had no idea that the hauntings kind of actually happened during the battle itself. I guess the biggest question is, will anyone ever really know who the horseman was?
Probably not. I mean, if we can look up the numbers, but it is constantly, apart from the Battle of Antietam, I believe, one of the bloodiest days in American history. And I mean, back then, this wasn't even in the modern day. You have people who die. We have the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier. We have people who just go missing or don't come back from war, and we don't know what happened to them to this day. So the idea of being able to go back and find, well, this specific guy died right at this time, and then boom, this appeared, I just don't think it's going to happen. But that is truly amazing.
One of my favorite things also is the fact that he was in full uniform, clean as can be, which just goes to show how maybe patriotic this person was before.
Well, and I mean, that during that point of the war, during the at the turning point of the war, your average Union and Confederate soldier didn't have their, you know, dress blues. Their clothes were dirty, ripped,
fresh,
no blood. Absolutely. Spattered, and we have just this vision of a pristine soldier just riding down the line. And the fact that later on in the day they go to take the hill, he's there, they get it, I mean, that's a premonition in and of itself, or an omen, I guess. But yeah, just crazy. Well,
quite amazing.
Well, what a story. But do you know what I think one of the greatest things about that era is?
Lincoln's sweet hat.
Well, you're close. I would say more of the man standing underneath it, though.
No, that's fair enough.
Abraham Lincoln seems to be the perpetual favorite child of America. Every time there's any sort of political discourse or bringing it back to Lincoln, what would he have done? How would he have handled this situation? And for good reason. The man is a myth and legend unto himself.
Yeah, did he really kill vampires?
Yes, part of the legend. Book somewhere. it's very well sourced, very, very thorough. Now, the tragedy, though, of course, was Lincoln's assassination. And that's what I'd like to talk about here. The details regarding Abraham Lincoln's assassination may not seem mysterious. After all, there is nothing supernatural or unimaginable about an actor wanting to make a grand display or a man being shot in the head. However, few know that while many people were shocked by the murder of the president, Lincoln himself had almost been expecting it. The evening of April 4th, 1865, just 10 days before Booth interrupted what was promising to be quite an enjoyable evening at the theater, the president experienced a bizarre and alarming premonition. He recounted the dream to his close friend and self-appointed bodyguard, Ward Hill Lamon, who transcribed the president's vision in his book Recollections of Abraham Lincoln, 1847 to 1865. Quote, "About 10 days ago, I retired very late. I had been up waiting for important dispatches from the front. I could not have been long in bed when I fell into a slumber, for I was weary. I soon began to dream. There seemed to be a death-like stillness about me. Then I heard subdued sobs, as if a number of people were weeping. I thought I left my bed and wandered downstairs. There the silence was broken by the same pitiful sobbing, but the mourners were invisible. I went from room to room. No living person was in sight, but the same mournful sounds of distress met me as I passed along. I saw light in all the rooms. Every object was familiar to me, but where were all the people who were grieving, as if their hearts would break? I was puzzled and alarmed. What could be the meaning of this? Determined to find the cause of a state of things so mysterious and shocking, I kept on until I arrived at the East Room, which I entered. There I was met with a sickening surprise. Before me was a catafalque, on which rested a corpse, wrapped in funeral vestments. Around it were stationed soldiers, who were acting as guards, and there was a throng of people gazing mournfully upon the corpse, whose face was covered, others weeping pitifully. 'Who is dead in the White House?' I demanded of one of the soldiers. 'The president,' was his answer. 'He was killed by an assassin.' Then came a loud burst of grief from the crowd, which woke me from my dream. I slept no more that night, and although it was only a dream, I have been strangely annoyed by it ever since." Unquote. This conversation took place on April 11th. The president would be assassinated in Ford's Theater just 3 days later. And you know, the thing about Lincoln, though, is he really loved this country. He loved this country more than anything else. So he was murdered that day, back on April 14th, 1865. But he kind of hung out.
Yeah, he went stuck full around. Term and then a little bit more.
Exactly, yeah. So, I mean, there have been multiple accounts of him actually continuing to haunt the White House, but back especially between like the 1920s and the 1970s, he was there a lot. People would sleep in the Lincoln bedroom, they would hear knocking and rapping and footsteps, and they would just have this feeling. They would know that it was Lincoln. The first time anyone ever saw him, you know, actually physically saw him face to face after his death that's recorded, was actually by Grace Coolidge, who was the wife of the 30th president, Calvin Coolidge. And he took office in 1923. She claimed to have seen the impressive figure of Lincoln in the Yellow Oval Room, which is a specific room that's used a lot for briefings or as a personal study of the president. And he was just standing there looking out the window, I should say, staring at the Potomac River. I can't even imagine seeing that. Just
because, I mean, he's a big figure,
he's a big guy.
I wonder if he had his hat on. No, he's a gentleman, he would have taken it off indoors.
Well, if you think about it, the hat probably isn't that presentable anymore. So
that's also true. I just figured the hat had its own, you know. spirit.
The hat is its own apparition.
That was,
I love it.
My second favorite thing about the American Civil War.
I understand.
Is that hat.
I can dig it.
Because he's already like, what, 6'4"?
He's six foot four, yeah.
Essentially.
Gosh.
But anyway, I'm sorry. Continue.
No, you're fine. So that happened shortly after Coolidge took office in 1923. And then you've got people. So we've got Grace Coolidge. We've got Teddy Roosevelt. And people like the daughter of Harry S. Truman said that they felt his spirit.
And I hear you have one particular person that you really like their story.
I was just getting to that.
Yeah, I'm going to let you continue on. Please tell us a little bit more.
I love this story. It's probably my favorite thing I found in our entire research in this past week. We all know Winston Churchill. We all know him. I don't know if we all love him, but we all know him. And we all know that there were three things he really loved. And that's, of course, warm baths, big cigars, and fine scotch.
I actually didn't know the warm baths part.
He loved warm baths. Have you seen The Crown yet? On Netflix.
No,
it's
great.
Phenomenal. And he is always in the bath.
All right. I guess I have to check that as well. Do some more research.
There you go.
Topic.
Yes. Do about 10 more
Maybe
hours of research.
Maybe whisk and scotch and a fine cigar as well.
There we go. He was enjoying all three of those things at once while staying in Washington. He had been in there a little while. He was getting sufficiently pruney. So he drained the bath and he strolled into the adjoining bedroom, naked as the day he was born. And I love the way it phrased this. It said, naked, but for his cigar. As if the cigar
is any form of clothing.
It's so big that it covers a part of his body. I won't say what part, but...
We all know what part of it isn't.
His chest. naked as the day he was born is how he went into that bedroom. And as he entered, he was met by the figure of a man 10 inches taller than he was and about 100 years his senior, standing in front of the fireplace and resting on the mantle. Can you even imagine if you are stark naked and not just the ghost of a president, but the president or even somebody you know from work
is just
standing
just in
the room?
You're getting a little nervous there. That's a little embarrassing.
For me, I'd freeze up.
I mean,
I'd probably cry. I'd probably scream. What did I say earlier? Churchill, I'd cry. I'd scream. I'd pee all at the same time.
He's a bit more clever.
He is legendary. Churchill's wit is legendary. He met eyes with the figure of Abraham Lincoln. He ashed his cigar, and he simply said, "Good evening, Mr. President. You seem to have me at a disadvantage." What a guy. It's said then that Lincoln simply gave him a wry, amused smile and vanished, but even Churchill himself was left grinning and blushing, which is not something I can really imagine of the British Bulldog.
So is this a story that Churchill himself told you or was telling, or was this something else dug up that...
I can't remember the specific source. I have it somewhere. I do believe it was... from his own words or from a biographer or something along those lines. I'll take a look and see if I can't find it to put it in the show notes, which, by the way, everything we discuss, all of the articles, the stories, all of that will be in our show notes in links down there. So keep an eye out there.
So personal bucket list. Outwit that little comment made by Churchill. That's good.
That's something to aspire to.
Absolutely.
I hope you never have to, I guess. I hope you never get confronted by Abraham Lincoln while... That's fair. But anyway, we've talked a lot. We've had a lot of fun stories about ghosts and all of that.
Apparitions in general. Now back to kind of the topic that I touched on earlier today. Crisis apparitions, as defined by paranormal researchers James Howard and Renz Lang. In their book, Hauntings and Poltergeists, Multidisciplinary Perspectives, a crisis apparition refers to a manifestation, generally at a remote location, of the ghost of an identified individual on the occasion of their death or undergoing a serious accident or some critical experience. One of the key markers of a crisis apparition is that the majority of the time, the person receiving the apparition doesn't know that the person they've seen is dead or dying. In some extreme cases, it may be that no one other than the recipient is aware of the friend or loved one's dire situation until hours or even days too late. For all intents and purposes as well, the recipient may simply see an old friend or loved one mysteriously appear and then vanish, with no frame of reference as to why it happened. Very much like the Ghost Rider of Gettysburg, these apparitions do not necessarily have any tell as their current state. They seem to be alive and well, it's not seeming hazy as a mirage or transparent image. Because of this, many people don't know exactly what they're experiencing as they experience it.
Interesting. Well, and a lot of our research as far as modern-day crisis apparitions come from, modern-day crisis apparitions comes from two sources. The first that I'd like to talk about is a book by a man named Edmund Gurney. Very nice.
Say that 10 times fast.
Titled Phantasms of the Living. It was published in 1883 and focuses on an extremely diverse number of topics, from the crisis apparitions we'll be discussing here to things like witchcraft, telepathic powers, and the nature of dreams and hallucinations. It's a really fascinating read.
Broad categories there.
Pretty much anything and everything in between. The cool thing about Gurney, and especially his organization, which was the London Society for Psychical Research, the cool thing about them is that they took the modern scientific method and applied it to the supernatural. They weren't simply happy with people coming up to them and saying, "Hey, I saw a ghost at Walmart yesterday." They went out, they interviewed anybody else who was there, they talked to the witness themselves,
or
they tried to take
hypothesis.
Exactly. Tested, repeated.
Yep.
Results. Now, it's kind of hard to get
a
crisis apparition to repeat itself. By nature, it only happens once.
If at all.
But they set the bar for modern ghost hunting and paranormal research.
Took a scientific approach to it, which that time probably was not typical.
No. And I want to do an entire episode. Hopefully we'll do one fairly soon about Victorian spiritualism in total. Everything, you know, from ghost children to visions, apparitions, levitation. This was stuff that was really prevalent around the turn of the century, and people were divided into a few different camps. You know, on one side, you actually had Harry Houdini, who was a skeptic, and he said, I would like to shoot all of those people talking about psychics. He thought that the majority of psychics, or technically all of the psychics, were just money-hungry people who were in it to try to make a quick dollar and just left people in emotional turmoil without providing any real closure or anything like that. It was a time in which the occult and con men had their day in the sun. But the SPR, the Society for Psychical Research, cataloged multiple cases of not only crisis apparitions, but all sorts of parapsychological phenomena, and made sure that everyone knew that they were in this not for the money. In fact, the researcher D. Scott Rogo said of their investigations of crisis apparitions that, quote, "Most of these early crisis apparition cases were less than dramatic. This peculiar banality impressed the SPR researchers, since it was out of keeping with the intense drama that typified fictional ghost stories. In fact, one early reviewer of the SPR's work suggested that these stories tended to put one to sleep rather than banishing it."
So, hey, look at that. Boring ghosts. That's
right?
Not something that we quite hear about in today's pop culture.
It's not your
no.
typical thing by any case, you know? And I think, again, to me, this is what lends credibility. You know, the main argument
you get...
Right,
we're not trying to get a headline. You're doing...
The main argument you get from skeptics is that the people who report these things are lying or wrong. And if they're lying, they're doing it for attention. They're doing it for a book deal.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. They just want whatever they can get. So for it to be the dreadfully dull, I mean, that says a lot. And Edmund Gurney wanted to get to the truth. You know, he didn't embellish or fantasize when it came to his work. He was not only committed to using the witnesses' own words to relay their experience, but he also worked relentlessly to corroborate any sources of information available to him, as well as took special care to examine the mental state of the recipient of these visions, making sure they were not prone to hallucinations or fits of lunacy. Only the most trustworthy of reports made their way into the Phantasms of the Living, which was their sort of catalog that they sent out, all of these different cases. And personally, I can attest for the most part that they are not the stuff of nightmares and horror, but they are rather a cold, clinical view of something that we just can't explain.
So that book's not being turned into a movie anytime soon.
No, it would probably have to be about 12 hours long, and you'd have to sell tickets at half price because all you would be going for is a nap. Now, it's worth noting as well, and this we'll get a little bit more into this near the end of the show, but Edmund Gurney did not believe these to simply be the spirit of the recently dead. As I said, he was a member of the Society of Psychical Research and truly believed that these interactions were more closely aligned with telepathy or thought transference rather than the spirit of someone else. But we've got some other more modern stories as well. You know, we started back in the Bible, we went up to the Civil War, we went up to the Victorian England, and our next stop, I think, is going to be present day. So
yeah,
go ahead, let me know what you got.
September 23rd, 2011. This is actually a report done by CNN, as titled, "Do Loved Ones Bid Farewell from the Grave?" And it's some really, truly amazing stories about crisis apparitions again. The first one is by Nina DeSanto, the owner of a New Jersey hair salon. As she was locking up on a Saturday night, she was confronted by someone she knew, a customer named Michael, who had been going through a rough patch in his life and had included a nasty divorce after finding his wife had been cheating on him with his stepbrother. That's not
rough,
easy whatsoever.
Man.
Yeah,
that's
and then
rough.
After that, he was emotionally shattered from it, and he was unable to actually retain custody of his children either, which he has a young boy and a young girl. For Nina, Michael was more than a customer. He had become a good friend. She cared deeply for him, trying to encourage him and providing a shoulder to cry on. They would often go out for drinks, and Nina would just listen, hoping she could help him through this in whatever capacity she was able to. However, this evening, he had a great big smile on his face. He looked happy. He looked at peace. He told her that while he couldn't stay long, he just needed to stop by and thank her for everything. They chatted there in the threshold of her business for just a few minutes more, and then parted ways. The following Sunday, she was told Michael was dead, that he had committed suicide. The salon employee who had called her informed her he had died Saturday morning, at least 9 hours before Michael appeared to thank Nina for being a good friend. She recalls in the interview, quote, "It was very bizarre. I went through a period of disbelief. How can you tell someone that you saw this man, solid as ever, walk in and talk to you, but he's dead?" Nina was left bewildered. Visual experiences like Nina's are what most people associate with encounters pertaining to the deceased. However, things like unexplained knocks or phantom footsteps are widespread and common in connection with hauntings as well. I'd be willing to bet that more than a few of you have stories of your own about hearing something in the dead of the night that you couldn't explain and left you shaken. However, knocks and footsteps, as unsettling as they may be, don't always end up being unexplained. From houses settling on their foundations to gusts of winds, old pipes, there can be many explanations that can be used to find comfort and quiet your mind as you lay in bed, wide awake for some unknown reason at 3 in the morning. But Sierra Lieberman couldn't explain her experience away. Sierra, who at the time of the CNN article was written, was working at a workplace diversity consultant in California, recalling a strange night around 50 years earlier in the 1960s. She had been enjoying a budding romance with her boyfriend Johnny, who, in her words, was an extremely nice guy, a mellow hippie who just loved people around him, and was accused of being a pushover because he was just too dang nice. They had purchased an apartment together and were planning on getting married when the time was right.
That's nice. Hopefully nothing bad happens.
Well, it wouldn't be a nice happy ending if we're talking about it now, right?
I mean, that's fair.
Well, unfortunately, the phone call came. She had been staying with her mother in the Bronx. As she answered the phone, she heard a distant, hurried-sounding Johnny. Through the static, she could make out his voice. I just want you to know that I love you, and I'll never be mean to anyone again.
Well, that doesn't mean... I mean, he could be fine.
Totally.
I'm sure he's okay.
That's not, you know...
Cryptic?
No, what? Okay. Not whatsoever.
No.
But then the line went dead.
Oh, man.
And no matter how many times she tried the phone back, she couldn't get an answer.
Oh, man.
She finally went to sleep worried. And when she woke the morning, although she couldn't explain exactly the feeling or how she understood it, she couldn't feel Johnny. As if he was nowhere to be found on the face of the earth.
Oh, man.
I know, man. We're going to get through this, I promise. She received a call several hours later from his mother. He had been shot in the head, sitting in the car. Sierra was loved by Johnny, cherished by him so much that he could not shuffle off this mortal coil without making sure she knew how much he felt about her.
Mm.
If given the chance, who among us would decline that opportunity to let our loved ones know just how much we care about them that one last time?
Well, I know I couldn't. Now, the last story we'd like to share is one that touches me personally, even more so than the previous two, which is hard to do. They're beautiful, beautiful tales. Now, as I'm sure none of you will be surprised to learn, I have had a few personal brushes with the paranormal. I'm not here to make this show about me. First and foremost, our mission is to bring you topics that incite discussion, that make you ponder and hopefully expand your worldview just a little bit. But I would be remiss if I didn't include my own story in this episode, especially with it seeming so weirdly similar to this final account from the CNN article. It focuses on a man named Joshua Harris, who in 1997 was 12 years old when his grandfather was diagnosed with lung cancer and given just weeks to live. Joshua, a resilient child, was determined to keep vigil with his grandfather, sitting by his deathbed through the night. But he was told by the adults to return to his home, which was about 2 miles away. He fell asleep on the couch and rested relatively peacefully until about 2 a.m. Then he snapped out of his sleep to see his grandfather standing above him and gazing down, smiling. Joshua says that he remembered a faint whitish glow encircling his papa. The kindly old man, still smiling, had only this to say to his grandson: "It will all be okay." Josh tried to get up and follow him as he walked away, but he took his eyes off of his grandfather when the phone rang. By the time he had looked back, the apparition was gone. That same minute, the aunt who had answered the phone hurried into the room, sobbing and full of grief, to inform her nephew that his grandfather had died. Now, this strikes a chord with me. A few years back now, I think it's been about 4 or 5, I lost a grandparent for the first time. His last name was also Harris. And I remember crying when I found out and at the funeral, but I wasn't prone to random fits of tears in the time in between. However, I'll never forget as I drove down the road to see my, at the time, girlfriend, I put on a song that always makes me think of him, "Hong Kong Cemetery" by Johnny Flynn. Now, I have no idea why my mind made the connection between that song and my grandfather, but it had already occurred by the time of his death. And as I drove, I thought about my grandfather, and I felt the grief that just can't be explained if you haven't experienced a similar loss. It was a fresh wound. He had only been dead about a week and a half at that point. I almost did pull the car over, just so I could cry for a few minutes. However, a little voice in my head told me to keep driving, so I drove. Suddenly, my sadness was gone, replaced by peace, and I felt a hand on my shoulder. And I heard my grandfather's voice tell me the same thing that Josh Harris heard: "It will all be okay." When I turned to look at my passenger seat, nothing was there, but his presence lingered until the end of the song. I went from almost crying to laughing. I was ecstatic. I had never before nor ever since felt that specific type of calm and peace, that feeling that no matter what, everything is going to be okay.
You know, I think your story there, and it reminds me a lot of my own grandfather's death, but very, very deep. And what was it, sudden passing, or?
It was. He wasn't in the best of health. or sorry, best of health, but he, it wasn't, he didn't have cancer. He wasn't, didn't have a terminal illness. He, basically he was well enough. He went up to our cabin, up outside of Loman here in Idaho, and he spent the whole day just ATVing and riding around and
business as usual.
Business as usual, you know, and that's who he was. He loved the outdoors. He loved hunting. He loved the woods. So he just spent all day just doing that, having the best day ever. And he was sitting on the porch, and the person who had gone with him, I can't remember if it was his brother or just a friend. I think it was his brother. He looked at him. My grandfather looked at him and said, "Well, I guess it's about time to go." And of course he was referencing, because, you know, he was feeling totally fine, but referencing, "Let's go inside, let's go to bed, it's, you know, 9 o'clock. But that's what he said, "I guess it's time to go." And his brother stood up, walked inside, or started walking inside, and then just heard a thump. Just right behind him, heard a thump. He turned around and my grandfather was dead. Started standing up, died in the middle, and fell back down. So, I mean, it wasn't super unexplained or unexplainable, but it definitely wasn't expected.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I myself have never really had that experience with a loved one very close to me passing on it and finding something happen afterwards in order to comfort me. But my mom actually did. And this is a little bit more of another story attaching itself to yours.
That's okay.
My grandfather actually passed away rather quickly as well, in a very kind of turmoil-filled time of my life, my family's life. It's when I was about 10, about a month and a half before my grandfather actually passed. My mom was diagnosed with breast cancer, and my grandfather actually died quite suddenly as well, in a small accident. But after the funeral, my mom actually woke up in the middle of the night and had a conversation
with
him, saying that it was okay, and he actually wanted her to come with him.
Oh, really? Interesting.
Luckily for me and the rest of the family, my mom is very stubborn.
She
and casted that advice to the side. She is doing exceptionally well today.
Good.
But, you know, it's... we do have those stories.
Yeah,
and
it happens.
For some of our loved ones, they absolutely reach out and try to comfort, try to help us in whatever way they feel like they can at that time. Speaking of which, let's go ahead and transition now to another close family member for you.
Family friend.
Family friend. My apologies.
You're okay.
Sam, would you like to go ahead and talk about Michelle and the apparition she experienced?
Yeah, so we're going to go ahead. We're going to play the full interview here for you in just a moment. But to preface it, Michelle is, just to put it bluntly, not a crazy person. She's not a kook. She's not a weirdo. I've known her for 3 years now, a little more than 3 years. And I know her as the director of my previous church's children ministry. So she's definitely not insane. Okay, they do background checks for that sort of thing.
Then again, we're trusting your words, Sam.
That's true, and that's not super trustworthy. But and even before that, she's been known to my wife and my wife's family for years and years. So just keep that in mind, and I would like to go ahead and introduce, with no further ado, our first ever interview on the Not Alone podcast, Michelle and the Apparitions. Cool. All right. So let's do this.
All right.
I did not really prepare questions. This is my first time ever interviewing anybody.
Okay.
I know I'm supposed to say this. Do I have your consent to record this conversation and use it for the purposes of making a podcast?
Yes.
Okay, cool. I've got it on video. I've got it recorded. So we're good there.
All right.
So, yeah, I don't have any pre-recorded or pre-written down questions or anything. I thought I'd just let you tell what happened, and if I've got questions, they'll come up, and if not,
okay. Cool.
But, so you said you had two different experiences, or just the one?
Yeah, well, the one I'm sure is a crisis apparition. Okay. The other is I'm not sure what happened because the person had died already and it was a few weeks mm-hmm. after when I had a vision.
Okay.
Of the person.
I had an experience like that as well that I talk about in the show, because we're just doing this one for all around apparitions and
yeah.
specific people appearing as ghosts. Mm-hmm. And I had a thing like that where my grandfather died. And about a week or two later, I was driving in my car, and I didn't see him, but I felt him, and I heard him, and so, right.
yeah,
but...
Well, I'll tell you both of them, okay. and you can use whatever you want.
Totally. So, go ahead. Set the scene for us.
Okay. Well, I'll tell you about my dad first.
Okay.
So, my dad had cancer, and he died. And we were all there when the day that he died. We were by his bedside, and he died at home. And we sang him out. We were singing some of his old famous favorite hymns, and sang him out on the way to heaven. And you know, because he had been so sick for so long, and we knew that he was going to heaven. That yeah, we were sad because we missed him, but. You know, relieved at the same time because he wasn't suffering anymore. So things went along. We had his funeral and everything. And about 3 days after his funeral, I've always had premonition dreams and visions my whole life. I don't pay attention to them because most of the time they're nonsense. They don't yeah. come true. They don't make sense. It's just weird. So my dream was about my dad. And so we were at Cuna High School. My whole family was there. And three of my nephews went to Cuna High School. So we were there and they were in the band. And so we were there watching the football game so we could see the halftime show. And I got up out of the stands to walk to get some refreshments at the concession stand, and people are pouring in through the tunnel and everything, and I'm walking out, and all of a sudden I see my dad standing there in the tunnel, and he was dressed in this yellow shirt that he had and brown pants and his black shoes that he wore all the time and the brown pants he wore all the time. And he had his hands in his pockets and he's walking along with the smile, the same smile that he always had on his face all the time whenever he was walking. And he looks at me and he nods like just like that. And he kept walking and in the tunnel, I'm standing, I'm like stunned, and my mouth is like, because I knew that he was dead, and I was like,
yeah.
So, and then so I woke up.
He had died, how, there you go. Yeah. So how much earlier had he died from that? Was it?
From the dream?
Uh-huh.
It was about, I would say, about a week and a half.
A week and a half.
After he had died. So, in my processing of why I dreamed that, but in my dream, I forgot to say yeah. that when I saw my dad, when I had that reaction, my mouth dropped open, but I had this heart, my heart just bam, like this pounding just hit, on
yeah.
my chest.
Yeah.
yeah. And shock and awe type, you know, and it took my breath away. And, but he kept on walking like it was mm-hmm. no big deal.
No big deal.
And that's when I woke up. So when I woke up, I wasn't startled or frightened or anything. But I woke up and I was like, why did I dream that? Because I know my dad's in heaven. Was it my dad? I don't know if it was my dad. And so, you know, I had to think
about
what exactly happened there. But, you know, and I told a few other people about why did my dad, why would he have appeared to me? Like that, and did some study about angels and demons and stuff like that. And I know that, you know, a lot of people believe that when you die, you die, you go to heaven or you
right.
go to hell.
You don't
and
hang then, out.
That's right, you don't hang out. And I kind of believe that way too. And so, you know, But in my study with angels and demons, I find out that these demons are pretty tricky little guys. Mm. And they know us pretty well because they observe us. And so, I don't know, I want to think that it was my dad.
Right, right. Well, it doesn't
seem...
The
other side that's like my logical side, like, no, because he was in heaven.
Right.
So
it doesn't seem malicious, though. I mean, it doesn't seem like,
yeah,
hey, come here and do something horrible. Yeah.
Yeah, no, it wasn't malicious, but, you know, I don't know if it was just like someone trying to say, open yourself up to this, and and this is a possibility, and man, I'm like, I probably won't go there, but...
Yeah, well, and I think a big part of it is, like, the impression you were left with. So, obviously, you were confused and bewildered, and I can understand that. But for me, it's always come down to how do you feel? So when you woke up, or even before you woke up, how did you feel in the dream? Was it a comforting experience, a positive experience, or was it freaky? Did it get
you? No, it didn't scare me. It didn't freak me out. I wasn't afraid, and I am afraid of the dark, and so I have to, before I go into rooms, I turn lights on, and dark rooms, I turn lights on and stuff. And so, but it didn't freak me out like that. And I did have a comfort and feeling that, oh, okay. To me, I think it was a reassurance thing.
Yeah.
And I was just, okay, yes, for sure, Dad is in heaven.
Yeah.
For sure, and he's happy. So that's what my takeaway, that's how I woke up.
Yeah.
After initial confusion, and then just thinking about it and talking with people about it, I think it was just a reassurance thing for me that, yes, yeah, he's in heaven. So
he's good to go, yeah.
So then my other dream is a little weirder, and I'm not going to say the names because I want to protect the innocent.
totally, you're fine.
My family knows about my dream about my dad, but a lot of people don't know about this particular dream. Just my kids.
Okay.
No, until now.
Right.
So anyway, so I had a friend who also died from cancer, and I knew her family, and so I knew her kids and stuff. And so, of course, when she died, I was really sad. But one night, I'm sleeping again, and I wish I had looked to see what time it is, because sometimes these things happen around the same hours. There's that. Study part of the study too, but I didn't. Anyway, I had a dream, and I was laying in bed, and she came and stood at the foot of my bed, and she was talking to me about, take care of my daughter, watch out for her, I'm concerned for her, please take care of my daughter. And I sat up in bed on my elbow, and I said, well, yes, of course, I'll take care of her, I'll watch out for you, but you know, she has her grandparents and she has some aunties who are going to swoop in and take care of her. And you don't have to worry, but if they don't, for sure I'll be there. And then she disappeared. And then I woke up and I sat up in bed and I looked around and to see if she was there, because it seemed that real. And she wasn't there, and I laid down. I was like, oh, that was a weird dream. And I go immediately right back to sleep. So the next morning, I get up, and things are going along normal. And I didn't even think about the dream. And I get the phone call, and it was people telling me that she had died that night. And then I was like,
wow. Yeah.
That is weird. And so I told Shane, my husband, and I told my kids about the dream, and they all thought it was weird. But I think, I don't know why dreams like that happen.
Yeah. Well, and in the little bit of research we did, we didn't have too much time this episode, but in the little bit of research I did, I found that most people are divided into one of three camps. You know, the first camp is that it didn't happen, you know, or not that people are necessarily lying, but, you know, in your case, you had a dream, it was just a random situation, has no meaning. The other one the other two are a little bit harder to define. One side believes that it's psychic things happening, you know, this person is while alive or in their last moments of death, but not dead yet, they project something to you or to somebody. And then the other half is that these people are dying and that that's their first act in being dead, as far as we can tell, is that they show up, you know, not physically, but spiritually they show up. Do you have any opinion on that, or do you lean one way or the other as I describe it to you, or?
I really don't know why she would have come to me and said, please take care of my daughter. Maybe it was me making sort of amends or something with the whole situation. Because she had said something to me way before she died that I had offended her daughter, but I apologized to her daughter, and I was like, I'm really sorry, I didn't mean to offend you, and you know, I didn't know that you were dealing with what you were dealing with, and I'm really, really sorry. So maybe it was me, but I didn't even know that she was in the hospital. And she had taken a turn for the worse. Right. She had the same cancer that my dad did, and they were suffering at the same time, and my dad died. And she was like, before my dad died, she said, you know, if your dad dies before me, there's no way I can hang out with you anymore.
Oh.
And I was like, totally get it.
I understand. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But, you know, my family and her family are kind of the same in that we laugh and joke about stuff that's horrible.
Right.
Because we don't want to cry about it.
Yeah,
and so her and I would sit and laugh and joke about so many things and about her treatment and the junk that she was suffering. And, you know, we would laugh about it. And so she lived about a year after my dad died. And so wasn't a lot of contact between her and I. And so I didn't even know that she was in the hospital. And so after I found out that she had died, I was like, that is so weird that she would come and say that to me. But, I don't really know why it happened because, you know, at the funeral, I talked to her daughter and I was like, if there's anything you need, let me know. I'm there for you. And she was like, yeah, okay. But, you know, everyone had been saying that to her all day long. You know, so I don't know I don't know. And I don't really have an opinion about it. It was just a weird situation that happened.
Well, so. Say okay as well. Yeah. I mean, that's the whole point of the show is, you know, we can sit and speculate and this, but we're not going to know. We're not going to know on some of the stuff until it's our turn, you know?
Until we are in heaven and know. Mm-hmm. So anyway,
those were great stories. Yeah. I don't think I got anything else. I don't think I got any other follow-up questions or you just did such a dang good job of explaining and talking.
Oh, you're welcome.
I guess the last thing is, and if I know that you're trying to keep personal names and all that out of it, how long had you known this person? Was it like a lifelong friend or fairly new?
We had known each other. I think we met when Shane and I she's from church. So, when we first started going there, so I knew her quite a few years. I knew her at least 10 years. Okay. So, we worked on some projects together, you know, so it was more, I would say we had an intimate friendship, but not, we weren't huggers, you know, like,
right. Yeah.
Like intimate, like it's Shane and I, and then the next step out is the people I let closer.
Yes. Yeah. No, I hear
you. You know, she was a good friend, she would probably be classified an intimate friend. We knew a lot about each other. We knew each other's families. We hung out with each other's families and did family stuff together, occasionally. So yeah, I knew her about 10 years, so.
Very cool.
Yeah.
All right. Well, cool. I think that's about it for me. Thank you so much, Michelle. And
you're welcome.
You know, if you ever want to talk about anything else about this kind of stuff, premonition, dreams, or anything like that, let me know.
Okay.
Yeah, hopefully this is the first of hundreds and hundreds of episodes. Okay. So.
Well, good luck. I'm kind of excited for you guys.
Yeah, it's gonna be good. It's gonna be fun. Well, hey, you have a wonderful evening, okay?
Okay.
We'll see you later, Michelle. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Sam, what was your takeaway from doing this interview?
Yeah, well, you know, of course there's a myriad of theories as to what crisis apparitions actually are, and especially in regards to Michelle's experiences there. But people usually find themselves in one of three camps. The first encompasses all skeptics, who say that these events either never happened, or if they did, they were dreams, and if they weren't dreams, they were hallucinations, and it's all just random chance. But even if that's the case, even if these things have no further spiritual or psychical implication, to me that still falls into paranormal. The odds that you're dreaming about these people, either right at or slightly after the moment of their death, I mean, those are astronomical odds if it's just going to be random coincidence. Now, as far as believers, or even just the more open-minded, most people believe that it either falls into the category of psychic phenomena or spiritual. Tonight, we decided to frame it in a more spiritual way, with these occurrences being the manifestations of the spirits of the dead, as we felt that to the average person, that's how they would be perceived. However, not that it matters in the grand cosmic sense, I want to go on record as saying that I believe these to be psychic occurrences, mental projections on the part of the dying that create a connection to their loved ones. I believe that the last thoughts of these people were those of the recipients that they appeared to, and that instead of it being their first act as the dead, it is their final act as one of the living. The Society for Psychical Research and Edmund Gurney categorized crisis apparitions as phantasms of the living, or ghosts of the living, because they as well believed that these were cases of thought transference as opposed to cases of haunting. Now, it's not something I'd fight someone over, and most people have trouble even seeing the difference between the two distinct categories of experiences, but when you've been looking at this stuff since you were about 10 years old, you come to feel strongly about little distinctions like that. The book we mentioned previously, Hauntings and Poltergeists, Multidisciplinary Perspectives, has an interesting passage on crisis apparitions. They posit that there may be some part of our subconscious that acts as a cosmic radar beam, scanning the universe for messages. They suggest that we may be actively listening for calls of distress, especially ones addressed to an individual personality, such as your own. The thing about crisis apparitions is that these are not psychics and mediums who report them. They are your churchmates. They are your hairdressers, your workplace diversity consultants. I don't believe you have to personally be special to pick up on them. You just have to be there, to have formed a connection with someone over time. You just have to be a good friend or an exceptional partner. The overwhelming majority of people who experience crisis apparitions do not view them as fearful experiences. They say they find comfort in them, especially after hearing the devastating news of their loved one's death. I know that in my experience, though it was not a crisis apparition by definition, it has provided me comfort multiple times and will continue to do so until the day I see my grandfather again on the other side. What about you, buddy?
You know, Sam, I think you hit the nail on the hammer a few times through that. I believe as well, like you do, that those crisis apparitions are the last real events that those living individuals
in a person's life.
Yeah, that is the last thing, not the first thing of death. And for myself, we're also missing still the science. I mean,
that's true.
We're not
that's
quite true. There yet. There are a few things,
and
that'll
be a common theme
right,
throughout
yeah.
this
we
podcast.
We're just
not there yet.
But there are some things that make me a little skeptical. I'm not too sure about. For myself, I think it's quite incredible what we discussed here today, and it was a wide range of things. But to the end is that we're just not alone, and there are definitely more things out there, and we might touch each other deeper than what we initially think.
I can dig it.
Sam, well, guess what?
What? Did we do it?
We did it.
We did it.
We did it.
Episode number one of Not Alone is finished. And if you're hearing this, it means that I have achieved my dream of being a podcaster, and Jason has achieved his dream of helping his friend achieve his dream of being a podcaster. Good job, buddy. It is your dream. Don't even. Anyway.
I was here for the cookies.
All right. Well, there were great cookies. Now, just so you guys know, we don't plan on being one-hit wonders. Not that this is going to be a one-hit wonder in any case, but we do have many stories and experiences that we're eager to explore with you, and would also love to hear about your experiences or your favorite stories you think we should take a look at. I'd like to invite you to feel free to drop us a line at notalonepodcast@gmail.com. If you've enjoyed this show or have any constructive criticism, we'd love to hear it. You can subscribe and review us in the iTunes podcast app or reach out through our Facebook page. We're also on Twitter at NotAlonePod and Instagram under the same handle, NotAlonePod. And finally, we've got our website up and running as well, currently at NotAlonePodcast.com. Make sure to take a look there, where we'll be posting an episode summary, as well as the links to the sources we used for our research during this episode. Thank you so much for listening. Right now, our publishing schedule is going to be a little erratic. I'd like to put out a new show every week, but every other week may be more realistic for now. So make sure to check any one of our social media pages or our website for constant updates as to when the next shows will be coming out and what they will be about as well. Until next time, remember, whether in the bright light of sunshine or in the dark blanket of a moonless night, we are not alone.